Following talk, entitled The Development of Buddhism by Lama Govinda, is presented by the Theosophical Society in America.
Namo Buddhaya. I want to speak today about the origins of Buddhism. You see, nowadays, most people in the West believe that Buddhism is a derivation of Hinduism. And this is a view which was more or less fostered in the previous century because people did not know that there was a great culture in India before the advent of the Aryans. The Aryans were actually invaders from the north, and they drove back the people to the south. As you know, in the south we have Tamils. And due to this fact that they were conquerors of an alien country, the people tried to keep aloof from the original population. So this is the origin of the caste system, because the caste system had a political background. The caste system seemed to be necessary to the conquerors to preserve their identity, and they tried as far as possible not to mix with the original population. Nevertheless, it happened to some degree, and therefore they had a kind of a system in which the different castes were shown as gradually coming up to the Brahmins, and the Kshatriyas, the Shudras, and so on, and finally the outcasts. The outcasts were actually those who were unmixed. Well, it's according to this principle, this was also reflected in the religion. It was actually only the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas who were allowed to have access to the sacred scriptures. The other people had to go through the Brahmins. And in order to keep the superiority of the Brahmins alive, they had another very big institution which really formed the kernel of the Vedanta, namely the sacrifice. Now, only the Brahmins were allowed to perform the sacrifice. Even the Kshatriyas had to employ the Brahmins in order to have sacrifices. And these sacrifices, naturally, were instituted on the idea of many gods, many powers which existed in this world, we may call them gods, which had to be pacified and had to be in some way to be modified. And so, therefore, without a sacrifice, people thought they could not get the favor of gods. Now, if we look at it closely, what did the sacrifice achieve? The highest ideal of the early Vedanta was to have as many cattle as possible, because India was an agricultural country and is to the even up to the present day. So therefore, the more cattle you had, the richer you were. That means everything depended on that. It gave you nourishment, it gave you prestige, it had everything. So therefore, the idea was, if you sacrifice, the more valuable the sacrifice, the greater is the sacrifice. This was the idea. So the current idea now was, at least in the former century, where most of the great scholars existed, they said probably Buddhism originated just like, let me say, Christianity from Judaism, or Protestantism from Catholicism, and so on and so on. In a similar way, the Buddhism was a kind of a reform movement of Vedanta, or of Veda, rather, in the origin. Well, this was a very, very feasible theory, but it is not borne out by facts. First of all, what is Hinduism? If we speak of Hinduism, it is a collective term for at least 100 different religions. We have such great differences in Hinduism that we cannot speak of one religion. So one can speak of Shaivism, one can speak of Vaishnavism, one can speak of Krishnaism, and so on. You can have so many different, as you know, there are six great philosophies in India, and these six darshans, as it is called, have quite opposite views. Partly they are theistic, partly they are atheistic, partly they are non-theistic, and so on. So we have got many different philosophies and many different views. And Buddhism is generally taken to be one of the six philosophical views. But now, how did the term Hinduism appear? The term Hinduism was more than 1,000 years later than Buddhism. And it was invented by the Arabs, because Al-Biruni, who came first to India, to Sindh, he found the Sindhu River. Sindhu, it means actually the river. And what is beyond the Sindhu River, he calls Hindus, or Sindhus. That means the people beyond the Sindh River, quite irrespective of whatever religion they had. Because to him, there was only one religion, that is Islam, and all the rest is put into one category, it's being non-Islamic. So the term which appeared was very much later. So how could Buddhism have been derived of Hinduism? Because there was no Hinduism at the time of the Buddha. At the time of the Buddha, we had the Vedic tradition, but nothing else. Or perhaps we are also mistaken in that. Because this something else was very important. There was a second stream of culture in India, which had gone underground after the conquest of the Aryans. This is the great culture of Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, which have been discovered only in this century. So therefore, previous scholars couldn't even talk about it. But since we now know that the Aryan religions were superimposed upon a much older religion, which was at Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, so we have now to see how was it possible that suddenly the second cultural stream, which existed all through the time underground, suddenly surfaced again in the time of the Buddha. And here we have the phenomenon. There was Jainism, there was Buddhism, there was a kind of movement of peripatetic wanderers, that means of sadhus, who did not adhere to the Vedic system at all. But for them there was no question of caste or creed or anything. They were just searchers for truth. And they followed a very, very old tradition. They were called samanas. And the Buddha, characteristically, in the Buddhist text, is still called Mahasramana. So this was not only a kind of a honorific title for the Buddha, but it was very significant because it put him into a historical perspective. Now, another thing, the Buddha was born at Kapilavastu. Kapila was the greatest philosopher of the old philosophy of the Sankhya. And this Sankhya system had an enormous great influence upon Buddhism. So Buddhism had its roots partly in the Shramanas, in the Sankhya, and perhaps to some extent there's also some great similarity with Jainism. So these three forms of religion, we are non-Vedic, and we are quite independent and much, much older. And here comes one thing which we have always overlooked. The Buddha himself spoke of the Sanatana Dharma. Sanatana Dharma means the eternal Dharma. It means something which existed from times immemorial. And even the Buddha said, I am not teaching anything new. I am teaching a religion or a truth which goes back into the past. And there were many other Buddhas before me, and I am only following the old path that was already created by them. This was generally, well, overlooked or not taken very seriously. But it seems to me that the Buddha actually referred to a tradition which was much, much older. And as we know, even Jainism is older than Buddhism, and certain similarities between Jainism and Buddhism are there. And let us guess that there must have been a very, very old tradition which was followed, as I say, by the Samanas. Now, another interesting fact is this. If we go through the Vedas very carefully, then you can find a very important fact. The very key term, the important term of all Hinduism and Buddhism and everything is missing. The word karma does not exist in the whole Vedas. Then how is that? That is the most characteristic term for Indian religion. You find, perhaps you will say, well, there is one similar term, the nirvana. But we quite overlook that the term nirvana was differently defined by Hindus or by Vedantists or by Buddhists. You see, the term nirvana in Hinduism is a metaphysical term. In Buddhism, it's a psychological term. And in order to prove this point, we only have to refer to the definition which the Buddha himself gave of the term nirvana. He said nirvana is overcoming of greed, hatred, and ignorance. There's nothing metaphysical about it. So therefore, all the metaphysical speculations which you find in later literature, for instance in the Vedanta, or in the terms of Shankaracharya, have nothing to do with the Buddhist idea of nirvana. So therefore, the same terms which have been used sometimes in Hinduism and in Buddhism mean two different things. And then comes the third point, which mainly led to great misunderstanding by all the scholars. You find in Buddhism that Brahma is there. But you will be astonished to hear that the Buddhist never conceived the Brahma in the sense of the neutral Brahma. That means the Brahma was actually one of the local gods, and the Buddha said, well, there are so many gods, there may be Brahma, there may be Sakka, there may be all sorts of different gods, but what does it matter to us? We have nothing to do with them. They may be quite good, they may be quite helpful sometimes, but you are not dependent on them. So since you are not dependent on the gods, why do you bring them sacrifices? If you want to sacrifice anything, you can sacrifice your own self, but you can't sacrifice other creatures and so to say, let them pay for your advantage and bribe the gods on top of it. So the Buddha was wise enough. He did not see anything against the gods. He said, all right, let them be. They are a good background. They are very nice to believe. But he did one greater thing. he introduced the term karma. Now, in the moment you understand what karma means, that you are responsible for your own deeds, in that moment the gods become superfluous, because it's not the gods who make your destiny, but you yourself make your own destiny according to your own karma. And now we come to another great misunderstanding. Karma is a very universal term. It has been used by the giants, it has been used by the Buddha, and it has been used later on also by the Vedanta. But the meaning, again, is completely different. For instance, the giants, they explain karma. They say any outer action that you commit means karma. And the Buddha said, not at all. The Buddha said our explanation is purely psychological. That means karma is volition. If you intend to do something, whether you do it or whether you don't do it, the intention is what makes the karma, not the outer deed. For instance, this is very much like in modern law. You can imagine, let me say, a bricklayer on a scaffolding, who maybe the brick slips out of his hand by mistake, and somebody who passes by underneath is being killed. That man, according to modern law, he's not a murderer. He is not guilty. He may be guilty of being careless, but he is not a murderer. But now imagine that somebody who is on a scaffolding and he sees his enemy passing underneath, and he aims at him and throws a brick in order to kill him, but he misses him. Yet he is a murderer, because his intention was there to murder that man, and whether he succeeded or not, the intention is what makes his karma, because your intention forms your character. And what we call nowadays character is very similar to what the Buddha meant by karma. So in other words, we demean our own character by a bad deed, and we raise up our character, we improve it by any good deed. And that is karma. Now the word karma itself, it is a great misunderstanding if you take it in the sense of destiny. Karma means action, purely action. And karma vipaka in Buddhism means the result of an action. So karma in itself means simply action. But now what is action? The Buddha explains it. He says action is what you do in your mind and by your speech and by your outer action, maybe sometimes. But if it must have the element of intention. If there is no intention, for instance, you may dream something. You may dream the most horrible things. Well, the dreams are not under your control, because in the dream you relieve yourself of any responsibility, of any intention. You simply are the object, so to say, of this particular bodily process. It may have some psychological interesting connotations, but nevertheless there is no intention. So therefore, if in your dream you do something which you would regard as not consistent with your intention, then naturally that is not karma. You make a dream anything. So, for instance, if you...
Thank you.
Let us say you are walking here in the garden, and while walking, there may be innumerable insects in your way which you don't even see. You may inadvertently step on one of these insects without knowing, Well, the insect is killed. According to Jainism, your karma would be affected by the death of that insect because you have killed it. It would be murder, so to say. But the Buddha says, well, even if you walk about and you have not the intention to kill that insect, it inadvertently comes under your foot. That is not your fault. That's not your intention. So it's not your karma. And according to that, you will see that the giants in India, they have a little brush and they have a cloth before the mouth. And with that brush, they will the whole time sweep the ground so as not to kill any insect by inadvertently, and even they will keep a cloth before their mouth so that even when they breathe, they might swallow certain invisible creatures and kill them. So in order to prevent that, they go to great pains. Well, in Buddhism, there is no such rule because we know that there is nothing in the world that can prevent us from a certain amount of destroying life forms. For instance, there are bacteria. Well, we would take medicine if we find that we have bacteria or something, or some kind of germ or so. But I mean, I think by taking medicine, you certainly you are not guilty of murdering any microbes. In fact, it is a sensible thing to do to protect your health, and nobody can blame you for that. So that is not in your intention to hurt anybody, it is only intention to keep alive, and that is no crime. In Jainism, on the other hand, there is a principle that even it would be very meritorious if you could starve yourself to death. And the greatest honor is bestowed on those saints who finally refuse to eat anything until they die. Well, that sounds very, very idealistic, very beautiful, but I think in the eyes of a Buddhist, it would be foolishness. The Buddha himself was going through a time where he went through great personal suffering, asceticism. Before he got the enlightenment, he tortured his body, he fasted, he did all the things, he was almost near to death, until he came to the conclusion that by torturing your own body, you can achieve nothing. But only in a healthy body, you can have a healthy mind, and you can only attain enlightenment if you have all got all your bodily faculties together. You can't expect that if you are bodily damaged, you can't expect to develop a perfect mind. In fact, this principle goes so far that in the Buddhist Sangha, you are not admitted even if you are a cripple. Otherwise, you're mentally all right, but if your body is not complete, you will not be admitted to the Sangha. Well, perhaps we might feel that it goes too far, but the principle behind it was that otherwise, probably, all the cripples and all the suffering people and all the ill people in the world would gather in the Sangha, because they would find this is the only way to make a livelihood. And since the idea was not to make a livelihood, but rather to be independent, so therefore they made this rule. So that's quite understandable. Now, another thing which will strike you, you must all have heard of the term ahimsa. Ahimsa is perhaps the most beautiful principle, both in Hinduism and Buddhism and Jainism and all these religions. I would say ahimsa is the common the common ground of all the Indian religions, at least nowadays. Well, you would be astonished to hear the term ahimsa, or non-violence, was absent from the Vedas. In the whole of the Vedas, the word ahimsa doesn't exist. That is really a central term. And why did it not exist? Because you can't have at the same time ahimsa and yajna, or sacrifice. Because how can you sacrifice other creatures for your own benefit if you have ahimsa? So the Buddha said, sacrifices, as long as they are concerning you only, all right. But if they are concerning others, you have no right to sacrifice anybody. And the only sacrifice is the sacrifice of your own desires. There's no other sacrifice. So therefore, the Buddha repudiated the yajna and the caste system, because the Buddha said, whoever wants to enter my sangha, whoever wants to be my follower, whether he is a shudra, or whether he is a kshatriya, or whether he is a vaishya, or anything, it makes no difference. In the moment you enter the religion, you divest yourself of any form of sangha. That was naturally a great blow to the Brahmins, because they had a monopoly for sacrifices. And this monopoly suddenly disappeared, so they were greatly upset by it. But the Buddha had nothing in itself against the Brahmins. In fact, the Buddha said always, he equalized the term Brahmana with one who has attained a certain spiritual height. And he even made a synonym for a bhikshu, which you can see in the Dhammapada. There's a whole chapter on the so-called Brahmanavaga, which extols all the virtues of a sacred or of a man, of one who has renounced the world and so on. And he uses the term Brahmana as the highest form of a human being. So therefore the Buddha is, now many people say the Buddha instituted a revolution against Brahmanism. No, he did not. In fact, he left even Brahma, but he had not the abstract form or the neutral form of Brahma, which was not yet in existence. Now you will ask, perhaps, how is it that in the Upanishads you find already an entirely different terminology, and in certain places you find great similarity with the Buddhist tenets? Now, the answer formally, before people had really studied the history of India, they made the conclusion, the similarity can only be due that the Buddha has been influenced by the Upanishads. But that can't be, because the oldest Upanishads, the oldest two Upanishads, were contemporary with the Buddha. And if the teachings which were given there would have been influenced Buddhism, then there would have been no need of a secret. But Upanishad means actually a secret law. It means, Upanishad means sitting near. You see, it means a secret doctrine which is whispered from ear to ear. And now the very funny part is, what did they teach? They taught the universality of what you call Brahma. That means they discarded the personal idea practically and made it a universal idea. And they introduced a new term which was anti-Brahmanic, namely the term of karma. And they were so much afraid that any of the Brahmins might know about it, that they guarded this doctrine more than anything else. And they whispered it only secretly to people because they knew that the moment they would introduce the idea of karma, the whole basis of Brahmanism would disappear, because there were no gods on whom we were dependent. Not that they would deny any form of other powers, all right, that we can do. We have in Buddhism, Brahma and other gods are recognized, as I said before, but they are not the deciding factor in our lives, and we need not bring them bloody sacrifices in order to mollify them and in order to get their good offices or something like that. We needn't bribe them, in other words. So the Buddha, the Upanishads, as you may know, in one of the very famous Upanishads, Yajnavalkya, who was one of the leading rishis, one of the leading wise men, there came Artabhaga, a man of the audience, and he said, Yajnavalkya explained, and he said, according to the Vedas, you see, the eye goes in the sun, and the hair goes in the vegetation, and the blood goes in the water, and in other words, we are going into the different elements of the world. And Artabhaga, he heard all this, it's very nice, then he says, but where's man? Everything goes here, there, everywhere, but where remains man? That means the idea of what you call now transmigration, was not yet created. It was not yet known. So, Yajnavalkya told the man, don't ask such question in the assembly. The other people can't hear. Afterwards, I will take you by the hand and I will lead you outside the assembly and I will tell you all about karma. And so the teaching of karma was regarded as a foreign introduction. And from where? From Buddhism, probably, or from Jainism, I don't know. But at any rate, it was not a Brahmanic teaching. So therefore, it had to be kept secret. And as I say, as the Upanishad describes this whole scene, he says that Yajnavalkya took the man by the hand and led him out of the assembly, and then they were talking secretly outside the assembly that nobody could hear them, and what they talked about were the principles of karma. So it shows very clearly that karma was a foreign introduction and not an original Brahmanical idea. So this is the philological proof for it. So, thank you. So as we see now, the same thing, more or less, has been repeated in Tibet. You will, just as the Buddha never rejected the Brahmanic deities or the Vedic deities, but he simply made them unimportant. I mean, they became, so to say, silent statistics. But a similar thing happened in Tibet when the great reformer Padmasambhava came to Tibet. He found an enormous resistance against the introduction of Buddhism. There was already an established religion of Burn, a kind of shamanism. In itself, I mean, it had good principles, but it did not quite, it had not come to the point to see things in a wider sense. So Padmasambhava was a great psychologist. And just as the Buddha didn't reject the gods of the soil, so he said, all right, you keep your gods, I have nothing against them, but take them into a bigger content. And he gave them the Buddhist teachings, embracing and introducing, so to say, these alien forces into Buddhism, and he made them more or less the guardians of the faith. So that was a very, very clever psychological point, because what he said was, in other words, if once you understand the principles of Buddhism, it doesn't make any difference how many different forms of forces or gods or this or that or psychological principles you would take into them. Because after all, there are different forms of forces. There is the sun, there's the moon, there's the water, there's the earth. All these things should not be regarded as something inimical, but we should understand that these are all forms of life, of the universe, with which we have to contend, which we have to understand, and it is only by understanding them that we can be free of them. As long as we don't understand them, we are not free of them. So it is not a matter of overcoming the influences, let me see, of terrestrial forces, but rather the understanding, and one very important thing is you should have compassion, because compassion is more even than understanding. Because if you have compassion, then you can feel with others and you can make others your own, and your own can become others. So this idea in Buddhism, these are the two pillars on which Buddhism rests. This is prajna, or knowledge, and compassion. If you have compassion without knowledge, then you, so to say, dissolve yourself. And if you have knowledge without compassion, then you are like a frozen piece of ice, or like a stone, that you are not sensitive. So therefore, it is both necessary, compassion and prajna, and wisdom. Because even if you are, let me see, if you are giving, if you are trying to share with others, even the giving should be done in the spirit of wisdom. You should know to whom you give and what you give and whether it is good. Because if you blindly simply give things, then you demean the other person by making him dependent on you. And without that, the gift can become a poison. We see that same phenomenon in the world politics. Nowadays, for instance, you will all know that America has given enormous sums of money to many, many other countries. If you imagine that these other countries are grateful, you are quite mistaken. They are not at all, quite on the contrary. They feel it is an insult, not as a... What I think is, if you give something, then make it possible for the one who receives that he can give something in return. That will satisfy him, that will make him, that will not humiliate him, that is the right thing. But if you give something without any inner relationship, only in an outward way, then your gift is more hurting than healing. And this, I think, is the great mistake of many politicians. They thought they could buy the friendship of other countries by giving them rich gifts. And that has completely failed. But if you give with a really full heart and full understanding, then the gift has value. Give anybody the means to help himself. That is a great help. But don't help without giving the means of help to others. So you understand the difference. If we speak now of Buddhism and Hinduism, then I would say we are doing injustice both to Hinduism as well as to Buddhism by mixing them up. If you see Hinduism in itself, it's a beautiful doctrine. It has many wonderful ideas, which we shall certainly respect. And in the same way, Buddhism has got and went a different path, which has its own riches, its own meaning. But just as if you go on a mountain, you can go from the south, you can go from the north, you can go from the east or the west, but you can't start on the, let me say, start on the east and suddenly halfway you go back and start again on the north or on the west. I mean, you have to follow whatever path you have got. And that path you must follow consistently. But if you try to mix two paths and start on this and start on that, then you will never arrive at the summit of the mountain. So therefore, it is not a question of higher or lower values whether you adopt Hinduism or Buddhism or Christianity or any other religion. The question is only that you should be consistent and you should understand that the differences in religion are not something that you should smooth over, but rather something that you should respect. Because if you go into a flower garden, into a garden in general, you enjoy the garden because of the different flowers and the different trees, the different fruits. But you wouldn't mash all the fruits together and make one hash of it. In fact, each fruit has its own taste, its own beauty, each flower has its own color, its own beauty. So it is the differences inside the garden which makes it beauty, not the uniformity. If you had a garden of only one type of trees or only one type of flowers or one type of fruits, it would be very boring. I mean, it wouldn't be regarded beautiful. So therefore, we have to understand that we are dealing with different forms of expression and that each form of expression has a relationship to all the other forms, and we cannot disturb that inner harmony between these things by putting in foreign elements. Now, for instance, I will give you an example. You have the term Shakti. I think you will know that. Shakti means actually something which is very powerful. And in Hinduism, it is said that the female emanations of the gods are his Shakti, that means the forms through which he acts, while he himself represents only the recognition, the wisdom perhaps, or the intellect of it. While the Shakti is the doer, is the action. Now, up to the present, to the beginning of this century, and you will find it in many books, the term Shakti has been indistinct, without any differentiation, been used in the form of Buddhist emanations of the Buddha. Now, that has led to a great misunderstanding, because in Buddhism, the woman or the female form of any god represents prajna, or wisdom, and the male form, action. And I think that's a more natural thing, because you associate with the male form the active activity, and with the female form rather intuition, wisdom, isn't it? So I think that instead of reversing the natural forms between male and female, we should clearly see the possibilities that action and wisdom belong together, like husband and wife. And if you have wisdom alone and you don't put it into practice, then it is of no value. But if you put it into practice, then it becomes something. And if you have action without wisdom, well, then you are a fool. So what is the use of action? So therefore, action and wisdom have to be together. And this is what Buddhism is all about. And all the other things derive from this principle.
This segment of the program has now concluded. The next segment will begin momentarily.
You should never attack another person or injure another person without being attacked or in any form to protect yourself.
There would be no karma involved.
Well, there may be some karma involved because there is some intention after all in you. But I don't think that it is the same thing as if you would attack another person. If you simply protect your life, you should do so in the easiest possible way. And if you have no other way left, but let me say, to defend yourself by violence, then I think it is justified, and therefore the blame would be very, very little. I mean, there would be very little karmic effect, because it doesn't strengthen your brutality or your intention inside. So, I mean, these are exceptional cases. In general, I find that if people live a very simple and clean life, then there is very reason for other or animals or men to attack you. So therefore, I say it is better to practice prevention before the thing happens.
But if you can protect yourself against the man running at you with a knife, can you not protect yourself against the germ that would necessitate you taking the antibiotic?
No, you have certainly a right to defend your body against the germ, just as you have the right to defend your body against the man. I mean, in both cases, it is not you who have had the intention to harm anybody, but you had been forced to defend yourself. And after all, the Buddha said, human incarnation is the most valuable, the most lucky of all. And we should value the fact that we are reborn as human beings, and we should make the best of it. And for that reason, we should keep our body intact and defend it against unnecessary harm from others. I think that is a very reasonable point of view. And I think that most people would feel that even if they don't know why, but they would certainly feel it. Yes?
Why is it that enlightenment must happen while you're in physical incarnation, while you're in
I think enlightenment, really speaking, can only happen if you are incarnated. Because without an incarnation, how can you be enlightened? I mean, even if you are in a higher form of world, let us say that there are perhaps higher stages than the human, even then I would say it's some form of crystallization of your life should be there, otherwise you wouldn't be distinguished from other forms of life. That means incarnation means only the centralization of your being, not something independent from the rest, but something which is, after all, concentrated.
You wouldn't be unenlightened unless you were.
Well, if you are unenlightened in this incarnation, you may have another incarnation in which you may get it, but it may be also more difficult, because even if you go into a higher world, then you are so comfortable that you don't need enlightenment, that you don't care for it. And if you are reborn in a lower form, which I don't think we will, but then we have not got the opportunities which we have as human beings. So in both cases, I think that the human incarnation is the realm of decision. And we should take that opportunity and not rely upon afterlife or anything else.
Getting back to karma, I was thinking if you try to lead as clean a life as possible and yet, for instance, your house is invaded by termites, And you call the exterminator, that would be intent to kill, wouldn't it? But on the other hand, you would end up in the basement if it was intent to
kill. Well, I think that, first of all, I myself had got a house in Ceylon, and I was faced with the same problem. Now, the first thing was that I kept coal tar on all the wooden pieces, and coal tar in the foundations, in the rafters, everywhere. That kept the white ants away. And I know that one day I came into my room, and I found that my whole mat has been eaten up by ants. Well, since that time I didn't put any more. So, I mean, there's very little you can do. You can only try to prevent them from the beginning as far as possible. Because if you would do nothing, life would become impossible. I mean, they would eat your books, your clothes, your everything. So it is different in every country. The same thing happens here probably with rats and mice. I can understand that. But even here, I think, we can at least try our best to avoid these creatures to come into our home. And if it happened in India, we had a little house there, and our house suddenly, which was in the midst of a forest, it was invaded by these rats from the forest. So I thought, the only thing I can do is put them back into the forest. And I put them away in a trap which would not harm them. It was a cage. And I carried them about half a mile away, thinking that they would find their own food and so on in the forest from where they had come. But unfortunately, they were more and more and more. And then I thought, maybe it's the same rats. the same rats which I had put out came back. So then, in order to find out whether that was the case or not, when they were in the cage, the tails hang down, and we colored the tails with the red stamp color. So then we found out that after some time, the same rats with the same colored tails came back. So from that day on, I carried them 1 mile or 2 miles away. And that was a better solution, because after that, it was too far away, and there was a slope of the mountain where they went down, and they didn't return. But I can understand that the difficulty is very great, but one can only try to do one's very best, isn't it? Because even if you are a vegetarian, you must be conscious of the fact that in order to produce your vegetables or your grains or whatever it is, the peasant will have to kill those marauding animals who would otherwise eat their crops. So you are partaking of something which has been achieved under great difficulty. And I feel always that we cannot actually separate our own guilt, so to say, from that of the poor peasant who cannot help himself. So my idea is, as long as you honestly try to avoid to harm other creatures, so long you are on the right path, whether you succeed in it or not is another question, but that certainly you have not the intention to harm other beings. And I think more than that, we can try to help other creatures as far as possible. Because the more we help other creatures, the more we understand them, the more we love them, the more we partake in their own lives. So I think everything in the world can only be achieved in a certain measure. And we should at least make an effort, and that will make it more possible later on to carry that out. Yes?
If you have just recently learned about karma, how can you go about erasing the harm you've done in the past?
Well, you can't change your past, but you can change your present. And your present is a germ of the future. So therefore, instead of worrying about your past, I think it is much more valuable to utilize the present and to create a better future. Yes? Yes.
Yeah.
Would you demonstrate how to sound the Om?
Would you demonstrate?
The sound Om is very difficult to demonstrate. I will try, but I must say that it is difficult in the sense if the sound Om comes from within yourself, then it is not only the physical body which is partaking in that, but something in your mind. And the real form of Om, which is effective upon others, is that sound which comes in consonance with your whole being and which represents a kind of a universal sound. I would say, that means you have heard only half. One sound is the sound which you produce by your breath. But this sound has an anushvara. You know, on top there is the anushvara on the if you write in Devanagari or in Sanskrit. And this anushvara means that the outer sound which you hear is transformed into an inner sound which, so to say, vibrates afterwards in your whole body. And that is the real Om. The real Om is not what you hear, but what you feel. And that is the sound which has great effect upon other conscious centers and so on. Even it may have sometimes even a physical effect. I remember once we were in the caves of Ajanta, or was it Ellora? I don't remember now. That there are the images in stone, huge images, and behind each image there is a passage. And you go around the image in the Pradakshina movement, from the sun movement, from left to right. Now, we used to go around these images in the Pradakshina way and reciting the Om. And we found, to our great astonishment, that the sound Om was taken up by the whole cave until it filled the whole thing with vibrations. And it became so powerful that at one time, when I sounded it behind the image, behind it, not before it, suddenly the solid rock began to crack. And we got a great shock because we thought any moment the whole cave may come down. But I mean, it shows that you have to maintain a certain pitch which is in exact proportion to the contents or to the space content of the cave, because each cave has got a particular sound. It's like an instrument. And if you get exactly, if you fit, or if you come to the vibration which fills exactly that space, then it has an enormous effect. So therefore, I said before, it is difficult to demonstrate because each room, each place would have a different vibrational rate. And therefore, the more important thing is what you feel inside.
The ones from the monk from the Kyoto monastery, and there's one other where they can chant their Om with at least three notes in the chord. Do they have to be trained from childhood, or can a grown man learn that?
Well, it is certainly a training. There is, if you are accustomed to chant it in unison with others, you will slowly get deeper and deeper in your voice, and you get a much more effective vibration. But I really think that it doesn't matter very much, because it is more important what you experience. It is good, so to say, you are transforming your mind and make it a focal point from which the effect goes out. And the real idea in all mantras is that we become the kind of transformation. We are a transformator, like in electricity. That it must be transformed in our own body in order to again have an effect upon others. And that transformation does not go only through our bodily pronunciation, but through our mental consciousness, which affects our surroundings. Yes?
If you allow someone to suffer, and you could help them, but you don't, how can you overcome that karma?
Well, I think that if somebody suffers and we are in the position...
But you have no intent to make them suffer.
No, I understand. But if you have, I would say, if you have an opportunity to help another person without doing so, then naturally that will result in a negative karma. And in a similar way, you cannot expect help from others if you don't give it yourself. But I think that it all depends on the situation. There, for instance, in Southern Buddhism, as you know, they are very strict on the different rules of the Vinaya. And I remember there was one story that a monk went on his pinapadang, it means on the arms round. And according to Buddhist rules, you have to not to leave out any house, you have to go consecutively after one after the other, whether rich or poor people. And when this monk went around on his arms round, he came to the house of his mother, and he stood before the house and quietly waiting for alms. In that moment, his mother fell into a well. And now it is one rule that a bhikshu is not allowed even to touch a woman. And he was so strict in his idea about the rules that he let the poor woman down. Now, this is an example of a wrong, I would say, of a wrong fulfillment of rules, because no rule is bigger than a human being. I think the rule should serve the human being and should not hinder it in the execution of a good deed. And in that case, it would have been far better to break his rule and to save his mother than to stick to his rules only mechanically and literally. So therefore, I think that that all the rules in Buddhism are meant to help us to develop our bodhicitta, or our enlightenment consciousness. And if they are not helpful to us, we should rather discard them. And therefore, in Zen Buddhism, you will know that practically all rules have been overruled in deepening meditation and inner development.